Good evening. I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas. It's very likely that you or someone you know is suffering from a serious depression, although you may not know it. Right now, over 3 million people are suffering from clinical depression in Canada alone. I'm not talking about the temporary feeling of sadness or the blues we all experience in the normal course of our lives. I'm talking about a debilitating disease which robs the sufferer of joy and can destroy lives and families. Because of this stigma attached to mental illness, it can go undiagnosed and untreated for years. One of our Ideas contributors has suffered through such a depression. Kathy Lesage is a writer and broadcaster who lives in Montreal. She was a nurse for many years, and she's married to a physician. They have 3 children. Tonight on Ideas, Kathy Lesage gives us an intimate view of what it's like to descend into a deep depression and then struggle back from its depths. Kathy kept a personal journal during the course of her illness, and you'll hear excerpts from it in this program. Along with Kathy's voice, you'll hear the voice of Alan, a successful lawyer from Toronto who struggled with depression for many years. You'll also hear the voice of Dr. Mimi Israel, a psychiatrist and teacher at McGill University, Dr. Sid Kennedy, a psychiatrist and researcher who's the head of the Mood Disorder Program at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto. And you'll hear from Dr. David Senior, the head of the Psychology Department at the Allen Institute in Montreal. Depression is an insidious disease. The symptoms are difficult to recognize. For Kathy, as for many others, it first took the form of fatigue.
September 10th. Finally, the move is over and we're in our new home. There's so much to do, though. I don't know how I'll ever get through it all. I know I should be more excited to be here, to finally have my own office where I can write to my heart's content. Instead, I just feel overwhelmed by all that has to be done, so much so that I can't seem to get anything accomplished. But how can I explain this to Tom and the kids? I'm the one who wanted to move in the first place. I'm the one who convinced them it would make me happier if we had more space. Maybe Tom's right. Maybe I'll never really be happy. September 22nd. I had my thyroid checked to see why I'm so tired all the time, but it's fine. So are all the other blood tests. So what's my problem? All I want to do is sleep. And I put on so much weight. I feel like a lazy, useless slob. Today, like every other day for the past 3 weeks, I sat amongst the clutter, paralyzed with some nebulous fear I don't understand. Trying to make a decision, any decision, no matter how simple, brings up this anxious feeling that just freezes me. I can't even decide which box to unpack or what to make for supper. October 16th. It's 4 a.m. and I'm awake as usual. It doesn't seem to matter what time I go to bed. That internal alarm clock starts buzzing. Come on, get up. Let's deprive you of yet another night's sleep. Maybe it's because I sleep so much during the day. But even after a nap, I still feel exhausted. I know I should be using my free time to write. Yet all I seem to be able to do is stare at the blank computer screen. To actually write something coherent takes so much effort. I can't seem to think in a logical sequence. And I'm so irritable with the kids. I'm always yelling at them for one reason or another. Tom says it's like he's walking on eggshells around here most of the time. Why can't I be a better mother or wife? Sometimes I think we'd all be better off if I just left.
It's like a hypnotic trance where you just can't do anything. You just don't care. Washing yourself becomes unimportant. Eating, everything. It's like you're numb. Just making a decision is excruciating. It doesn't matter what the decision even is. Decisions are excruciating. When you are in the midst of a depression, it's horrible. It's horrible for the person who's living in it, and it's not fun. It's scary for the people who are watching it. I'd be scared if I met somebody in that state too a bit, because you just don't know what's going to happen. The person who's having it really doesn't know what's happening either.
October 28th. I saw my GP today. I got to thinking, if it's not my thyroid or anemia that's making me feel this way, maybe I have a brain tumor. I told him about my muddled thinking, my anxiety, my exhaustion, my inability to sleep throughout the night. I wanted him to send me for a CAT scan, but he insisted I didn't need one. I got a reassuring pat on the arm and was sent on my way with a prescription for sleeping pills. Just what I need to sleep more. I got the feeling he saw me as just another paranoid, bored housewife. Maybe he's right.
An interesting fact, when you look at patients going to see a family doctor, if they volunteer several different areas of symptoms, one of which is depression, but another is a more physical condition, it's been shown that the doctor is much more likely to pick up on the other conditions and perhaps leave the depression untreated. So there is a tendency or a bias, if you like, both at the family level to deny depression, and there's also a professional bias to treat other conditions. You know, everybody has to have a model of how they see an illness, and clearly a broken leg or a heart attack is a very clear model of damaged tissue or damaged bone. But the model for depression is really still being worked out.
Often, though, what people will complain with is the physical symptoms. It also depends what kind of doctor you are. I'm a psychiatrist, so by the time people come to me, somebody said to them, maybe you're depressed, maybe you should see a psychiatrist. But certainly in family practice, people present with fatigue, with difficulty sleeping. Men will more often endorse physical symptoms, whereas women are more likely to talk about their emotions. People often talk about the anxiety associated with depression. The fear, the sense of impending doom. People will report things like they can't concentrate, they can't make decisions. Because what I'm saying is that depression affects a lot of aspects of our lives, not just the way we feel, but the way we think and the way we function. Surprisingly, sadness is the last thing that people feel when they're depressed, and we tend to confuse unhappiness with depression. So if the person is coming saying, I'm unhappy, that doesn't necessarily mean they're depressed. Depression has a certain quality to it, which is very different from sadness or unhappiness. It affects every aspect of your life. It affects the way you think, the way you perceive yourself, the way you perceive your future.
November 15th. I went to a fundraiser with Tom tonight. I managed to get some makeup on and comb my hair. God, I dread these events. It's so hard to get dressed up when I don't give a shit what I look like. But the worst part is I can't seem to follow a conversation for more than a couple minutes. it's like the people around me are speaking a foreign language. I recognize a word or two, but can't put them together to form any meaning. It's so exhausting just trying to keep track. I remember a Far Side cartoon where, in the first frame, there's a man talking to his dog. The second frame shows what the dog actually understands. Essentially, it's just blah, blah, blah. Lately, I've been feeling just like the dog. I see the mouths moving, but nothing seems to register. What's happening to me?
You know that people don't like these signs or symptoms, and you know, as sick as you are, you know when you're with other people, you really can't let on, because if they find out, well, they'll put you away somewhere, and that's terrible. So you have to play this actor's role. And I remember so many places, for those that 4 months in particular I'm talking about, where I was the sickest, I would go to functions, and I would just absorb myself and whatever was around me without anything coming out of my mouth to do with myself, to make sure that I was, A, nobody could guess how sick I was, and also that I could just sort of get through the evening by doing what everybody else is doing, just blending in.
When people are depressed, it doesn't mean that they dress bad. Or sometimes people let go of their personal appearance, but sometimes people still put on their makeup and comb their hair. And so even to physicians, they'll react to the fact that, well, the person looked fine. They were all made up. They can't be depressed if they had time to put on makeup. They don't realize that depressed people fight to appear okay. It costs a lot of energy, but they do it. And really, by the time they can't do it anymore, you're talking about a very ill person.
December 3rd. Tom came home tonight, and as usual, I hadn't gotten a thing done all day. The dirty breakfast dishes are still in the sink, and the unpacked boxes still sit in the hallway. He's trying to be patient, but I know he's getting fed up. He says I should be more grateful for what I have and try to focus on all the good things in my life. I wish it were that easy. I've really been trying to take better care of myself, improving my diet, trying to take more walks, but nothing seems to be helping. I can't understand it. I'm still so exhausted, I could sleep all day. And sometimes I do, although I'd never admit it to anyone, not even Tom. How can I explain to him how I feel when I don't even understand it myself? I'm so ashamed to feel like this when I have so much.
Depression, you can't talk about it. It's embarrassing. It's humiliating. You don't want to talk about it. Other people don't want to talk about it because it's scary. And there is still, because the symptoms are so horrible, it is a thing of shame to behold. You have no energy. You don't care. You're fighting with your husband. You don't love your kids anymore. You hate your job. You'd rather be dead. Those are things of shame to share with anyone.
In fact, it's even harder when you have everything to be depressed. You tend to blame yourself more and say, well, what's wrong with me? Why can't I feel good even though I have my health or I have a good family or I have money or I have a job? That only augments the guilt burden, because one of the big feelings associated with depression is guilt and the tendency to blame yourself for everything. So that's just exacerbated when everyone around you can't understand what's going on inside of you, because people look at, you know, what they see.
December 15th. Today, I managed to put a load in the washer, but then I slept off and on for the rest of the day. I haven't done a thing for Christmas. I don't even know where the decorations are. It feels as if I'm wearing a lead suit or trying to walk submerged in water. Everything feels heavy. My arms, my legs, my thinking. When I talk inside my head, it sounds like a record album on too slow a speed. This can't be normal. But no one knows what I'm going through, how terrible it feels to live like this day after day, with no energy, no drive. I don't look forward to anything anymore. And I must look awful. I'm fat. I haven't washed my hair for over a week. I don't even bother to answer the phone or the door anymore. Having a simple conversation just wipes me out. Besides, I've nothing to say that's worthwhile hearing anyway. I just feel totally empty. Everything seems so pointless.
There's still a stigma surrounding depression, which doesn't apply to other conditions, it seems. I think part of it is that people imagine that depression is simply the blues, and it's something that you can get out of if you distract yourself, or we hear family members tell depressed people, why don't you just pull yourself up by the bootstraps? So there's still this idea that it's a personal weakness as opposed to truly a bona fide medical condition.
Well, I think part of that is linked to the stigma associated with having things in the mental illness department. In other words, whereas if you had cancer, everybody would feel bad for you and everybody would identify this as a catastrophic event. When you talk about being depressed, different people will react to it according to their experience or their expectations. They may see it as a weakness. Can't you solve your problems? What's wrong with you? Can't you pick yourself up and get out of this? So people are more likely to be secretive about it. It's not exactly viewed as something, you know, that's accepted to be depressed by a lot of people. I think men have a very hard time with that. You know, it's viewed as being emotional or not being in control of your emotions. I think it's hard to tell your employers that you're depressed. People are afraid of retributions. They're afraid of being discriminated upon. And I think in many ways they are, if they present that way. So in that way, they have to suffer in silence.
December 30th. Christmas was a nightmare, but I managed to fool everyone as usual. But I feel like I'm barely hanging on. Tonight I screamed at the kids like a complete wacko. I don't even remember what they did to make me go so insane. I cried for a while, then slept for 2 hours. They must have made their own supper and got themselves ready for bed. It seems like this scenario is becoming a nightly routine. Everything they do bothers me. I can't wait until the holidays are over. I can't stand the noise and the chaos when they're around. I just want to be alone. I think they're becoming afraid of me. Me, their own mother. Hell, I'm becoming afraid of me.
Given that nobody or very few people understand depression unless they've been through it or they've been educated in some way, often the partner, the other people in the family don't understand what's going on. And they react to what they're seeing, which is either someone withdrawing, not talking. Like I said, people aren't always sad in depression. Sometimes they're irritable. Sometimes they're impatient. Sometimes they even get angry. They may have angry outbursts. And so this causes, obviously, stress within the family. It affects other family members. From the point of view of the children are very sensitive to changes in their parents. So they get scared. They see one of their parents not being the same, and they don't understand it. And often, you know, kids have active imaginations and they will think the worst. I've often met with the children of my patients and asked them, you know, are you worried about something? Do you have questions to ask me? And they'll say something like, does mommy have a bad illness? Is she dying? Sometimes people, when they're depressed, just in the way they talk, it's a constant negative dialogue. So obviously it means that the family is constantly either being criticized or being presented with a view of the future that's scary. Like, you know, people start saying, you know, we won't have enough money, nothing will ever go right. I think one of the big causes of conflicts between couples is depression. In other words, sometimes I've seen people presenting as their primary complaint a couple problem, and it turned out that one of the partners was depressed.
Typically, what we hear from people who suffer depression is that their family, their close friends, don't really understand why they continue to be depressed. And there is a theory that, in fact, initially, when somebody becomes depressed, everyone rallies around and offers support and encouragement. And then as time goes on, and if the person remains depressed, the family and close friends begin to withdraw, all the while saying, no, we're not withdrawing, we're still here for you. But they provide ungenuine support because they're tired and they don't understand, because they liken what the person's going through to their own occasional days of feeling blue, which is really does disservice to the depressed person because it's a different animal. And then this puts the depressed person in a further sort of cycle of being isolated, getting this ungenuine support, and it cascades and makes them feel even worse.
January 10th. Tom took the kids away for the weekend so I could get some work done. But I spent the entire time in bed accomplishing nothing. I'm so tired of being like this. Oh, and something else has been happening. A few weeks ago, I started to have these weird images in my head. They don't last long. They're just momentary flashes of a gun going off beside my head, or my car falling off a cliff. They happen so quickly, I've no time to react before they're gone, except maybe to think, what the hell was that? They don't really scare me. They're more surprising than anything. What's going on? Is this what it feels like to go insane? January 29th. Those flashes I've been having have now become more like entire films playing over and over in my head. I know it sounds strange, but they've somehow become a source of comfort to me. The constant anxiety I feel seems to disappear when I'm planning how I would die. It's the one thing I'm able to think clearly about. I can lie on my bed and go over the details for hours. What to say in the note, how I will do it, where, when. The only problem is every time I think I've come up with a perfect solution, there'll be another detail I forgot. And then the planning starts all over again. I'm always thinking about how to make it easier for my family, just to deal with what I've done. Sometimes I imagine myself walking out on the ice until I reach open water. But then I think how horrible I'll look if they didn't find my body until the spring. Then I imagine driving my car over a cliff. But I think, what if I don't die? I just end up paralyzed. Sometimes I think this planning could go on forever.
the brain gets obsessed because it's looking for a way out. That's really all it cares about. I mean, you're not eating anymore, you're rude to your friends, or you're hiding, sleeping, watching TV, reading, just living a passive life of almost non-existence. Meanwhile, your mind is saying, well, we have to stop this somehow, or we've got to do something. And I think you start to obsess over and over again on those meticulous details of how you're going to kill yourself, because you really have nothing else you can cope with thinking about. You're too depressed. And so your mind scurries to the only place left it can think, and that's about stopping yourself from thinking at all, so you won't be depressed anymore. That's all you really want to do. You just want to stop the depression, finally. And so I finally worked things down to, I had a cartridge pen, and I used to fill it up from a bottle of ink, and I used this old syringe to spray the ink into the empty cartridge. And I thought, well, I'll just stick this syringe into my arm, and I'll blow air bubbles, and they'll go to my brain, and I'll die. Well, of course, my brain immediately says, well, I hate needles. So I would spend weeks wrestling this dilemma, am I going to stick myself with this needle, but I hate needles. Of course, what the brain's really doing is saying, well, you're not going to do that because there's a defense mechanism that will not allow you to kill yourself. The very few people who ever do that go way, way past that point. Most people don't kill themselves because their brain will not, even though the brain is ill, their brain will not allow them to take that last step. Thank God. It's the most horrible, of course, point you could ever reach. If you're living that particular time, there's nothing worse. That is the rock bottom of rock bottom.
We take up Kathy's journal 6 months after the onset of her depression.
February 16th. I saw an old friend today. I hadn't seen her in a year. She dropped by unexpectedly, and for some reason, I answered the door. She told me the reason I hadn't seen her was because she'd been suffering with clinical depression. She was now on medication and felt great. I asked her question after question about her symptoms, about how she felt. It was all so familiar. The insomnia, the exhaustion, the anxiety, the inability to think clearly. After she left, I walked over to the library and read everything I could about clinical depression. It was all there, in black and white. This must be what I'm suffering from. It was such a relief to know that what I'm going through has an actual medical name. God, and here I am a nurse and my husband a doctor. And we missed it entirely.
Depression is a cunning fellow. It has different ways and different times of attacking you. I look back now and I realize that the time in which I dropped out of Carleton, I hadn't slept for a couple of weeks, my lack of concentration and focus, and generally that things just seemed pointless at the time. That was my first attack, as I call it, of depression. But the unfortunate thing about that particular illness, of course, is you don't really know. These are not signs that, like the flu, you'll say, oh, I have the flu, because other people have the flu, and you can relate to the symptoms. And from that period of time on, for the next 13 years in my life, I had these regular bouts in the fall, and then again in February, as it turned out. And I didn't even know that for many years. I didn't know there was a pattern or, as I would call it now, a seasonal effect. Because each and every time you would come up with a discussion about the situations in your life. Well, you know, now I'm 21 and my girlfriend broke up with me. Or there would always be a factor that was a current event that, well, you would chalk up to your age or your particular circumstance. That's one of the tragedies of the illness. I think it's one of the reasons why people kill themselves if they get horribly sick, which happens to a few. And I think the shame is part of it, and just the general mental exhaustion of the devil that's in your mind that you just can't live with anymore.
I think we're seeing real headway over the last two decades, bringing depression as a major problem for Canadians to the forefront. But I think we still, both at the personal and at the professional level, we have a bias against acknowledging that a major mental illness probably accounts for more work impairment, dysfunction in families, and potentially suicide and death than probably most other illnesses.
And in fact, funny for a psychologist to say, but I think in some ways depression should be medicalized, in the sense that children, family members should be educated that this is not this is really a medical condition that needs to be regarded as that. One of the recurring phrases that we hear from people that we see who are depressed is, "I would rather have cancer. I would rather have a physical illness," not to trivialize cancer, but they speak of a pain that for a non-depressed person, and by the way, including myself, even though I work in this area, is really hard to understand. But I've heard it often enough to take note that for the sufferer, it seems worse than a physical illness. And I'm not sure why, perhaps that it's ever present. With other illnesses, you might get some respite. But with depression, it is when it strikes, it is ever present, it colors everything.
March 7th. I saw a psychologist today. I had planned to be so cool, to check her out before I spilled my guts. Instead, as soon as she closed the door to her office, I burst into tears and cried for the entire hour. Between sobs, I told her everything, even about the thoughts of killing myself. I haven't shared those with anyone. She kept saying that even though I didn't have a fever or some other tangible signs of an illness, I was sick. She recommended that I start taking an antidepressant right away and that she should see me at least once a week until the pills have had a chance to work. That could be as long as 2 months. I told her it's difficult for me to take medication. It's like admitting I'm weak somehow, to have to rely on pills to get through the day. She told me just to think of them as insulin or thyroid pills. Lots of people take daily pills. At this point, I feel so awful. I'll do or take anything. Maybe there's hope for me after all.
People often search for meaning, so there's this idea that there's a reason, and if I can find out the reason why I'm depressed, somehow that will make me no longer depressed. I suppose the analogy would be we understand that middle-aged executives who are under enormous stress, sleep-deprived, perhaps don't have a healthy lifestyle in terms of exercise or alcohol consumption or whatever, are at risk of heart attacks. Maybe they also had a genetic risk. Now, understanding why they got the heart attack is clearly not going to treat the heart attack. And I think in the same way, we need to recognize that more active treatments often need to be included as well as trying to have an understanding. Probably antidepressant medications are the most commonly available and easy to deliver treatments. But people also have options in terms of cognitive behavior therapy, interpersonal psychotherapy. These treatments are as effective in the mild to moderate spectrum of depression as the medication treatments. And in some cases, combining the psychological treatment with a medication is actually a very powerful combination. I often like to say to my patients that the medication treatment is often a first step as an enabling agent. And antidepressants are enabling agents that restore some of the functions, the concentration, the energy, the sleep disturbance, the alertness or interest, and then the person is enabled to make choices about psychotherapy, gradual re-entry into work, re-entry into life in whatever way.
No, I'm a firm believer now, and I know from practice, I wasn't taking pills for 13 years. I kept getting sick. I started taking pills, and in the last 13 years, I've practiced law for 12 years, and I have 2 more degrees, and I've been very successful. I was allowed to be the person I always was. These pills don't make you into something. They simply allow you to be what everybody else is. You just don't have that black cloud that slowly seeps into your life. If you're going to fail something, you're just going to fail because you failed. You're not going to have this disability that's handicapping you and holding you back and costing you all the time. So then you can live and breathe like everybody else, be successful or fail. You just have a level playing field with the rest of the world. That's all those pills do. I don't feel any different when I take them. I just don't get chronic depression attacks anymore and become paralyzed.
Arguably, a real part of the iceberg of depression that's very much under the water and has hardly even been exposed are those individuals in the workplace who struggle on year after year at a 50% of optimal level, don't really know that they're depressed, don't get treatment, and are so... could be so much more productive citizens in life, if you like, if they were treated.
March 23rd. I've been taking my little orange capsules for almost 3 weeks now, and I see the shrink once a week. I haven't noticed much of a change, but Tom says he's noticed a difference. I just don't know anymore. My perspective is all screwed up. I forget what it's like just to feel normal. But it's true, I haven't been sleeping as much during the day. And the suicidal thoughts have definitely decreased. I still feel pretty empty, though. But I just think of my kids, and it helps me to keep going. Last night, Tom and I talked to them about my illness. They didn't say much. I think the whole thing has been pretty scary for them. I feel so awful about what I've put them through. I'm not sure how much they understand. But they were so good about it. And they said they'd try to be more helpful and patient with me while I got better.
Our important goal is to educate family that this is not something willful, this isn't, the person didn't invite this, and that they should not become over-involved, because we do know that contact with depressed people can put others at risk for becoming depressed. If you're speaking to someone and they're negative and they view the world and the future is negative, you're bound to, through some sort of echoing, start to kind of believe it yourself. So to protect oneself, one withdraws. But if you're aware of that and say, okay, I'm going to set my limits. I won't spend all my time, but I will be there. And then I will go and look after myself, and then I will come back. Very much as though you're a caregiver for a cancer patient or someone with Alzheimer's. You really need to, as a family member, to protect yourself, but at the same time not withdraw the support which the depressed person really desperately needs.
Once you've had a depression, even when you come out of it, there's repair to be done. Usually because the depression has had an impact on your life, or your job, or your family, or whatever, but also because it's almost an insult to your personal, your sense of self. You know, you feel vulnerable, you wonder what happened, And to face life after that is difficult. And so even when you're better, you need help in readjusting, and you remain vulnerable, really, to future episodes unless you've had that kind of help. So generally speaking, in an ideal world, everyone should be treated with therapy when they've had a depression.
April 8th. I spoke to my mother today, and she told me she'd been on antidepressants for 8 years when she was about the same age as I am now. Then she told me about Granny, lying on her bed crying for months and months. And then I remembered my brother. He was hospitalized during his time at university for a nervous breakdown, we were told by my parents. I can see it clearly now. This disease has been in my family for generations, and yet we never talked about it. Why? Is it shame? Guilt? I now know I was born with a genetic vulnerability to a real and definable disease. I hate the fact that my kids probably have it too. But at least they can be educated. I can help to teach them so they don't get to the desperate point that I did.
When I went to law school, I had another attack. And I happened to come across a doctor who was retired, who is now in Kingston, named Dr. Laverty. And when I saw him, he said to me, well, did anyone in your family ever take any pills for anything, for depression? I didn't know what he was talking about. So I called my mom up, and she told me about my grandfather. And my mother had had situational depression when my father died, and she'd taken amitriptyline. So I told that to the doctor, and I now was missing 2 weeks of law school. And I knew I was going to fail my year. I was 30 years old. And so I said to the doctor, well, I'll eat worms if it'll make me better, because I need to be better in 10 days or I'm going to lose my year. And he said, fine, take this pill and you can come back in 10 days and we'll see how you are. And I went back on the 10th day and I was going to resign from law school. And I got to the school and I went to see the doctor. I said, well, I'm going to resign from school. I'm not better, you know. I went over to the dean's office to resign, and I got into her office, and I was in the middle of telling her, I'm going to leave law school now, I'm not any better. And as I was talking to her, I sort of looked over her shoulder, and the sun was coming in the room, and I thought, oh, it's a nice day outside today, isn't it? And I thought, I guess you're noticing it's a nice day outside today. And I suddenly started to realize I was noticing that, you know, things weren't that bad today as I thought they were. And, well, why was I resigning from law school? And I suddenly said, you know, I think I'd like to give it another try, if you don't mind. I caught up, I finished the B average, and I knew the minute the medication worked that I had turned the corner, that this was the answer. I mean, I'm luckier than most people. A lot of people, you say, take medication. Oh, I don't want to take a pill. Oh, I didn't want to take a pill. I didn't take a pill for 13 years. Pills for people who are weak. Yeah, well, I think so, but unfortunately I have to take a pill. And then I thought, well, I guess insulin's for people who are weak when they have diabetes too. And it suddenly became very apparent to me that if this pill has this effect on me, I don't really care what people think about it. I got on my knees and thanked God that I didn't have to have one more minute of this disease running my life.
Depression really if we consider the origin of depression, it's multifaceted in the sense that there's genetic contributions. We know that depression runs in families. There's early experiences that can in some ways lead to depression later in life, losses. And certainly stress can precipitate a depression, but really it's very individual. There are some people who fall into a depression apparently out of the blue without any identified triggers, whereas others can say, yes, in the past year I've suffered a number of losses. So it's really a question of we view it as a vulnerability which is brought on by your history, your genes, and then coupled with a severe stressor or a loss can lead to a depression. But again, it's very individual.
Well, there's no doubt that having, for example, one parent with a diagnosis of depression will increase the risk to an individual that he or she could present with depression at some time in his or her lifetime. Overall, I think the challenge is to understand how that genetic risk for some people never transfers into the actual diagnosis becoming apparent. And for others, of course, it does. And I think that's where life stresses, coping mechanisms, healthy attachment in childhood, good resources, good support systems of friends and so on, can actually all serve as protective factors. We talk a lot about the risk factors to cause the illness. Perhaps we need to also think about the positive protective factors that can either lessen illness or hopefully even prevent it occurring in the first place.
April 20th. It's been almost 2 months since I started taking the medication, and I've been seeing Janet regularly. It really helps to talk to somebody who understands. We've been looking at how I deal with stress, trying to figure out if there's anything else I can do besides taking medication, anything else that will lessen the chances of this happening again. The pills have definitely been effective, although it's not as dramatic as I had hoped. She says we may have to fool around with the dose for a while before we get it right. I may even have to take them for the rest of my life. Well, if I have to, I have to. All I know is I never want to be in that place again.
There are good things that come out of depression. There are good... I'll tell you one thing. I have never enjoyed life as much when I'm healthy, because when I am, I can. There's a little part of me that says this: just not being depressed anymore is great. And just the enjoyment of life, the challenges now are a little sharper, a little more rewarding. I just get a kick out of not having to lose several months a year of my life to a devil that I really couldn't control. I think you learn from those things how tough you are, how strong you can be, how to enjoy life, and maybe how to face other challenges better than some people, because you're challenged all the time by this illness. And when you master it, you start to believe in yourself even more finally, which, is, believe it or not, was rewarding for me. I knew I had courage after I licked this black dog.
Depression is very much a chronic illness. Unfortunately, even one episode produces a risk of 50% for an individual of having another episode. If you've had three episodes in the past, the risk of having another episode is 90%. So that really raises a number of questions. What should somebody do after a first episode, after a second episode? And we do know that the continuation of antidepressant treatment, for example, for at least a year, and also being very careful that all the symptoms are in remission and not just a partial remission when somebody discontinues treatment, has a profound effect on the relapse rate. People who stop too soon or stop with residual symptoms have about a 50% risk of relapse in the next 6 months. I think people can also learn to detect early signs of change in themselves. Is it a slight sleep pattern change? Is it a particular thinking style or a welling up of tears at a certain time that might be the clue? And everybody will have a different personal clue, but that may be a time to begin to think of interventions. For many patients who've had three or more episodes, the treatment is a lifelong treatment.
May 12th. I've started to write again, and it feels great. I'm even toying with the idea of going back to do my master's. I never thought I'd say that in a million years. But I know I have to take it slowly. I still worry about what all this has done to the kids. So I decided my first project will be a book. I talked to the kids about it, and they seem keen. We've decided to write about our experiences together with this disease. So so that it can be shared with other kids their age. Even if it never gets published, it's a way for us to heal the wounds. It's been a tough journey for all of us.
I was ashamed for 20 years. Now I know, and I'm comfortable with the shoes I have, and I'm comfortable saying what I'm saying. You're never cured of depression, ever. But you can control it as you can diabetes and learn to live with it and master it and seize your potential back, as fortunate I've been able to do.
May 18th. I went for a walk along the lake today. The sun was absolutely brilliant, and there were about a dozen sailboats on the water. For months, I've looked at this scene and felt absolutely nothing. But today, something was different. I actually thought, wow, this is really beautiful. And for the first time in a very long time, it felt good to be alive.
Tonight on Ideas, you've been listening to Journey into Darkness by Montreal writer and broadcaster Kathy Lesage. Along with Kathy, you heard Alan, a Toronto lawyer, Dr. Mimi Israel, Dr. Sid Kennedy, and Dr. David Signor. The program was produced in Montreal by Jane Lewis. Technical operations were by Serge Brideau. The executive producer of Ideas is Richard Handler, and my name is Paul Kennedy.